Hey, movie lovers! Today we honor another horror movie here on Anatomy of Movie, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Ari Aster's feature film debut with Hereditary, and that is the movie on the slab today, if you will. We have Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans, what's happening?
You guys know him. He's a regular. And joining us today, you guys might know him. He's done behind the scenes for us, and he's also appeared a couple times for horror movies. You know him from Horror Movie News if you watch that show. Anthony Becerra.
Hello, everybody. Can't wait to grab my scalpel and cut this movie open.
And I'm Phil Svitek, excited to be here with each and every one of you guys. Couple things administratively out of the way. First off, a very warm welcome as we dive into this very warm movie. Secondly, if you're joining us for the very first time, A, understand that it's going to be spoiler-filled, so you've gotten your warning right here,
boom,
right now.
There it is.
So if you haven't, go see the movie. And for a movie like this, there are going to be spoilers, so I highly recommend tuning out, going to see the movie, then checking back in with us. And lastly, of course, if you want to follow along, we do have our rundown in the description box. It's got a lot of great information that we'll try to touch upon, but may not always get to every single little bit of information, so that's there for your convenience. Without further ado, though, we start with overall thoughts to kind of give you an entry point into, obviously, what we thought. And Anthony, why don't you kick us off? You're the guest of the show today.
Sure. I was a little thrown off by the score that we're listening to, because that's like the ending of the film, and that's so eerie to me, especially with the demonic chorus at the end there. I really enjoyed this film. I think it's one of the best horror films I've seen in a long time, specifically because of how it made me feel and how I wasn't able to shake it off for the next couple of days, and how it truly affected me on such a deep level emotionally that, like, even I noticed it, like, right away. It's like walking out of that theater, I drove home and I couldn't even bring myself to turn on the radio because of the way I felt, and I liked how it made me feel, and I wanted to revel in that feeling a bit more because it's something I don't feel walking out of theaters that often. And for that moment, for the sake of that alone, it's something that has deeply impacted me since I've seen it, and I've been wanting to do nothing but watch it over and over again. And so far, I've only seen it twice so far. But overall, I really enjoyed this film.
You really want to pay tribute to Payman, huh?
Yeah. Oh, hell, Payman.
And Dimitri, what about you?
Look, I think this is a movie that has some of the scares from The Conjuring. It has the languid creepiness of The Witch. And, you know, with a dash of Rosemary's Baby in there. I think it's well executed. Pacing, we can discuss a little bit, but I thought that it was a little overlong. It's definitely not the movie that the trailer sold, which I know we're going to talk about. And it's a good horror movie, but I do not believe it's the be-all, end-all of horror movies that have come out recently. There have been scarier pictures. Not that this one didn't leave me creepy. I mean, it's a very creepy movie. And I think from a direction standpoint, from a creative standpoint, he does some things that are a little bit different. Like showing you where a creature is, like in full frame, where sometimes it's usually shaded out, blacked out, or not in the frame, and then it becomes in the frame. So there were interesting choices that I really liked, but I also, there was a lot of Wes Anderson in this movie that was between the miniatures and the way that he moves his camera very simply, the way Wes Anderson will use miniatures, and he'll do like just pins or tracking shots, which I found very interesting in a horror movie. But there's something that's happened with this movie too that I don't like, that this movie has built up a pretentiousness of people going, well, if you don't like this movie, then you're not a horror fan. You know, horror isn't just jump scares and slasher films, which I agree. But just if I don't like this movie as much as maybe other people, doesn't mean I don't know horror. I like to believe I sort of kind of do. So that's been happening here, and nobody really has been saying, well, you know why the reason that people don't like this movie is because they saw a trailer that sold them a bill of goods that the movie itself was just clearly not. And we'll go into more marketing and why I feel that they probably did that. I mentioned before, it is from the people who produced The Witch, and it has that similar kind of pace, and it draws you in. When we get to talking about the end, I actually felt that the end of The Witch was more earned, and this one was 10 minutes of exposition, which I'm not entirely sure I needed, because I was getting it. And there's another reason, too, when we talk about the end. But, oh, Toni Collette. You hadn't mentioned Toni Collette. For genre movies, I think her performance is as good, if not one of the better performances in a genre picture that goes right up there. As good as, like, a Vera Farmiga. As good as almost a Mia Farrow.
I was about to say Mia Farrow.
She is... Also, she's wonderful. I mean, she's great. It's not something you always expect in a horror movie. So kudos to her. The rest of the cast, too, I felt did a really good job. But I'm going to dissect this movie when we get into talking about how I've seen it's people doing, like, stupid things. Like, really? A seance? How many times in the movies have seances gone right? So, you know, but like I said, it delivers chills. It's a scary movie, but not the scariest movie I've seen, but scary nonetheless.
I think, you know, for my money, it's a very metaphorical movie, much like there's a lot of comparisons, and I don't want to spoil by any means Mother for anyone who hasn't seen it, but it's very much part and parcel of that as far as the marketing. You get one thing, but the movie delivers on another. And it's very, very metaphorical. Both are relatively contained into a house overall. Mm-hmm. This one actually goes beyond a house, so at least that's nice to see. But you really, even what you want, like, let alone the trailer, is not what you get in the movie. The movie is not what you're really getting, and you have to kind of think about it on a deeper level. And it's interesting to think about it in those terms as far as metaphor. You know, you certainly, like, when you look at superhero movies, they're supposed to be metaphor of sort of us as heroes, in a sense, but we've all essentially kind of taken it very literally. I feel like there's apprehension against anything that forces us to think. But to the same time, I think some of his first-time directorness of a feature film comes through, and it's a little too much. Like, for example, you know, we can talk about certain things, but, like, the cutting of the head off the pigeons and so forth, very, like, hey, look, we're about to foreshadow your head is about to come off, meaning Charlie's. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just there just to foreshadow. And it's cool that there's things there. Like, if you really rewatch it, I'm sure you noticed the second time you watched, Tony, like the pole itself, when they're driving to the party, they stop on the pole.
Yeah, it's foreshadowing.
That's cool.
Yeah.
But there's other stuff that's a little bit more gratuitous. So anyway, that's my thoughts.
But to your point, though, this is a far more accessible film than Mother could ever want to be and pretend to be. Regarding the metaphors of Mother, you know, had they not been spelled out what this is about, the environment, like, the environment? Like, what the hell is... You know, today I'm still scratching my head. That movie made me so angry.
That's
personal. This movie has more of a through line. So, you know, I always find that the best movies, or really good movies, are ones that you can dissect and you can dig deep and go from metaphors and symbolism and such. But on a simplistic level, they should be able to just be watched. And they should, you know, they can evoke a feeling, whether it's horror or not, or comedy or drama. But then when you want to dive deep, you can. You know, I think Hereditary is that type of a movie where you can talk about motif, you can talk about symbolism and motivation and metaphorically, but you can also look at it as a horror film as well. So I think this movie, Leaps and Bounds, is a far better movie than Mother is. But from a marketing standpoint, too, there was that similar thing.
Well, let's kick it off in terms of we've used the word metaphor multiple times now. That's fine. What is the ultimate message or whatever you want to call it, theme of the movie? What's the takeaway? I certainly have my, you know.
The takeaway of this, at its core, it's a family drama that experiences a great tragedy in the family, and it's a study of how sometimes the family doesn't recuperate from that tragedy, and they slowly start to spiral out and lose it. It's self-destruction of the family because of this tragedy that they experience, and it slowly turns into a nightmare. And it's a study of this family that just isn't able to recover. And sometimes that's just how life is. And sometimes families break over tragedies like that.
What about you, Dimitri? What was the?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the demons that can be carried within a family, and it's not only its history, but its present and its future. The demons that can plague a family, whether it be through tragedy. I mean, Ordinary People is a movie, not a horror movie, a full-on drama, but a movie about how tragedy can tear families apart. There was another movie not too long ago in which, you know, there was a family tragedy and it tore a family apart. And this one, because it's a horror movie, like, the demons can be metaphors as well. I wish they were more metaphoric than they were actual, you know, because like I said, the last 10 minutes of the movie explains everything to such detail that it doesn't leave any imagination as to what's happened here. So that actually was a little bit of an issue with me. But for me, it's the demons that a family can take, whether it's a matriarch passing away, a family, a child passing away. I think Toni Collette said it very, very well when you talk about the demons of a family from their past, when she has that monologue in the grievance group. Amazing performance. I mean, she's so captivating. But I think it says it all about the dynamics of the family. And there was a tragedy that was it. That was the fatal blow.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's very much, as the title implies, you know, you whether you want to or not, a lot of the stuff, you know, I'll use the word shit, a lot of shit from your family can get passed down to you whether you want to or not.
Yeah.
And I use the word shit in this case very deliberately because, yeah, by no means does Peter want any of this. I don't even want to call it responsibility, but that's the only word that comes to mind in the moment.
Yeah, he's always trying to escape it. Every time he lights up that lighter and he smokes a bowl, that's all he's doing. It's all escapism from, like, the bullshit that his family, that he just doesn't want to deal with. And so he's a recluse from his family.
Well, and Steve sort of represents that to the father in a sense of, like, not knowing how to deal with this. What one of the things where it really starts to unravel, though, is we teeter this very fine line between psychosis and supernatural, and you don't know what's real and what's not. And I appreciated that. And then when it comes to it is actually all supernatural stuff, it almost it takes too much away, because in thinking back on it, I'm like, okay, well, like with Paimon and his any of his abilities and things like that, it wasn't quite as set up, and it doesn't have the same impact as it should. Mm-hmm. It isn't an epiphany moment. It's like, oh, this is what it is. And Dimitri, you seem to share my similar feeling on it, but Anthony, you don't, so I want to get your perspective.
Yeah, so, sorry. I actually didn't get that when I was watching the film at all. I knew it was supernatural from the get-go. I don't know how. I just knew it was like, yeah, there's a cult behind this. Not once did I think the mom's crazy. Not once did I think that Toni Collette is losing and this is all in her mind. Like, never, in the first viewing, never did it cross my mind until I heard people talking about it afterwards, where like, yeah, like some there was a theory that was like going around that was that it's all in her mind and this is all like a symbolism for mental illness. But that's all dispelled at the very end. So it's hard to speak on this because I didn't actually see that when I saw this film. I picked up on the symbols, I picked up on the necklace and the signs from Payman and everything. But apart from that, like I was still able to enjoy it. Like it's I guess I could agree with you that everything is kind of spoon-fed to you at the very end of the film. But I still, it didn't really take away much for me in reality. I mean, if anything, it's just like for audiences to really like, no, this is what's been happening and it's all real. Well, it's not mental illness. Like this is what it is.
You know, for me, one of the interesting, like when I look at it and I talk about the foreshadowing, right, with the cutting off the pigeons right. Very early on. Remember the classroom scene? They say like they're talking about, I forget what
Destiny. It was Heracles and
yeah, it was almost the same exact thing that was being taught to Laurie Strode, except hers were the five elements and destiny, between destiny and fate. It was right. Almost that. It was almost a similar parable being taught in this class. That's the first thing I thought of.
I actually read in an article that the same line that was written on the board for Peter was written in the classroom for the first Halloween movie about like escaping your destiny or your fate. And that's like pertaining specifically to Peter, who's like trying to run away from this fate of like having all this family like shit being unloaded onto him. And I think that's what it is at the very end of the film. As much as he wanted to escape all of this from his family, he takes on the burden once the crown is put on his head.
But does he though? See, this is my other big problem. What do you mean? This is my other big problem with the movie. He dies.
Yeah.
He does not make that choice. This is my difference between the ending of The Witch and the ending of this movie. The ending of The Witch, you have a girl who's in this super fanatic religious family that is so fanatic, they get thrown out of their own religious case in New England.
Right.
They go, they build up this whole thing. This whole supernatural thing goes on. And at the end of the movie, the girl has a decision.
Right.
And she makes a decision and she becomes part of a coven or believer of Satan. With Black Peter.
Yeah. And then realize Peter.
In this movie, he dies.
Right.
He's not given the choice. He just dies. The little sensor thing that was in Prometheus now is, he gets taken over. Like that light, that bright, that
little
light.
Oh, yeah, that's supposed to symbolize payment and everything.
Yeah.
Also, just to point out on that scene when he's on the ground, do you notice how like the shadow that leaves him?
Yeah.
But it's also Toni Collette's bodies. I thought it was really cool, like symbolizing two things.
Yeah, no, it's all good, but his choice is taken away. He is taken over.
Right.
And so it's not like it was a humanistic. Right there, it takes out the humanistic element.
How does it take out the humanistic element of it?
Because his body's taken over. His dead body is taken over.
No, but the symbolic gesture here is that he never had a choice. No matter what he could have done, this was going to happen to him eventually. Then that's something that happens in life. You know, it is life. It's death. It's like, you know.
And then his body was taken over. This is what I'm saying. Like, he had no choice about. He didn't make the choice to become part of this cult.
Just he like died. He didn't have the choice to be part of this family that was so broken.
But he died, and his body was taken over.
No, but besides that, it's not. It doesn't matter. That's at face value. You gotta look. Looking past that, it's symbolic of him taking on the responsibility that he was always running away
from. He's not taking on any responsibility. He's dead. He's not taking on a responsibility. His body is taken over. If he was in this situation, much like the girl in The Witch, and he says, you know what, I'm going to give in to this. That is a humanistic choice. He's dead. His body gets taken over by Payman, goes up the stairs, and then we're spoon-fed as to what's going on here. So He doesn't have a choice.
Well, let me ask this. Would it satisfy you if he realized he didn't have a choice, that one way or another he was going to die, and therefore just let him succumb to Paimon and be like, okay, overtake my body?
At least it would be a choice, or you try to escape from where you're at. And the other thing, too, is we've seen people jump out windows before. Unlike, like, The Exorcist, which...
Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
Clockwork Orange.
We've seen people jump out windows before, and they've, like, lived. So it was... I didn't know whether or not he was going to live or die, but then they purposely show that that's a dead body, and that dead body, now it's just become a vessel for Satan. So...
Amen.
Same thing. So that, to me, right there, it's like... It wasn't a humanistic choice. It was a humanistic choice to jump out the window. There may have been, like, maybe some hope that he could survive the fall. I don't know. But in the end, he's dead. So he has no choice. So he becomes this Paimon. He becomes this god. And then we're,
because he doesn't have the choice, does that take away from what the meaning of the film is still trying to gesture, though? Like, as in that...
He just gets taken over. He's got no choice. Like, he's just taken over.
Well, here's what you guys are illustrating is a far larger point. And Forbes, here's a paraphrasing from them. It's hard for psychological arty horror movies with an unhappy ending like Hereditary to do well, because for audiences they tend to either not be scared enough or be too scared. So they have a 2/3 disadvantage. Like Goldilocks, it's neither too hot. It's either too hot or too cold, never just right. So you're the 1/3 that liked it.
But let's go to Rosemary's Baby for a moment, right? Rosemary was manipulated, okay? She doesn't die at the end, but she's manipulated to do... She doesn't die. She's not taken over. It's she realizes the horrificness that's been done to her.
Right.
Okay? That's horror. When you are being raped by the devil... Right? You're carrying Satan's son, and you're not given the choice in that, because that choice had been made by other people. Like, that is something. I mean, she's alive. That, to me, is more horrific than a dead body that literally has no choice and no say in what happens, and then it just gets taken over by an entity.
But what you just said is described, is also, like, shown throughout the whole movie, that whole element of, like, their lives being controlled by this cult the whole time.
I wasn't buying that they were being controlled, like, because... But they were, though. But I don't buy that I do believe that Toni Collette's character had some mental illness, because the mom had some mental illness, and even though she was in this, even though the mom was in this cult, let's call it, Toni Collette didn't know anything about the cult. She didn't even know her mom was into spiritualism until she found the books.
Right.
Like, so regarding the necklace, she didn't know what that... And I noticed the necklace, and I was like, oh, this is going to pay off sometime. Mm-hmm. She didn't know.
Well, that's
know.
The problem. I think that's the inherent problem, is that when you start to try to blur the line between is this real, is this not, as opposed to just kind of having it be outright supernatural, then that's where it starts to deteriorate.
What starts to deteriorate?
The whole crux of it, as far as, wait, it, you know, if Toni, if Annie herself was worried about, you know, her mother, and she was into weird stuff, she knew that she was into culty stuff, but that also, it gets sort of sidelined because she had DID, and, you know, the family has a whole history of everything,
right?
And so it's like, okay, it just tries to raise too many questions very early on, very deliberately, and then says, but hey, didn't we fool you? We're going to take that away. And it was the supernatural stuff to begin with.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's my issue, is that it tries to be too clever about it. You know, it's to me, it's like the same, you know, speaking of Toni Collette, yeah, she was in The Sixth Sense. To me, it's like that same thing, to be honest. I think that movie hinges on, look at me as a clever filmmaker rather than something deeper. Because it hides a fact.
And I like the fact that throughout the movie, at least for me, I was guessing, well, that's pretty harsh what she admitted about her son and wanting to like burn him in gasoline. And like, to me, that's a mental illness. That has nothing to do with the supernatural. She's a little bit off her rocker. But I liked how it kept me guessing.
Yeah.
So, because she didn't know about this seance stuff. And that, to me, is another thing. Like, if somebody suggests a seance, and especially when you go, well, what language is this? And the person says, oh, don't worry about it. That's when I start worrying about it.
I don't know. I can appreciate the cleverness. I didn't think it was, personally, I didn't think it was trying to be too clever. I think I really appreciated it, like, that little swerve after I heard about it. And then I went back for the second viewing, and I was like, oh, I can see how people can perceive that she's mentally unstable and why she's doing some of the things she's doing. But like the whole paint thinner incident to me was her subconsciousness trying to protect her children, because she knew deep down within herself that her children were in danger. And it was all, and also the guilt she feels at where she says that in the grievance counts, grievance group, she said that she's to blame, that it's her fault. And I think that comes from her subconscious. And she says, she's like, what are you to be blamed for? And she says she doesn't know. I think that's her subconscious is trying to break through, saying that I had these babies and it's my fault that they're doomed from the beginning since I had them.
But no sane person, no sane parent tells their kid flat to their face.
Yeah, and that was all a dream. And if you notice, that's all a dream. And that's again, her subconscious is breaking through, telling him that.
Like, I didn't see that part.
That's a dream. At the end, they end up being lit on fire. That's a whole dream sequence, and that's going into her psyche and telling him why, like, this happened. And it was because she was afraid, and then she had him because she was forced to keep him by her grandmother, by her mother, because the mother wanted to put the soul of payment inside of her firstborn son, because the mother already tried to do that with Annie's brother, and he hung himself because of that same reason, and who knows what happened to the father. But
I think the problem is that they each carry, like, as we talk it out loud, each character teeters too much on one and the other, where they got to be a linchpin and hold a specific viewpoint. You know what I mean? So if, let's say in the case of Annie, because you can't. Like, then it creates too much discussion. Annie should be like, no, my mother was into supernatural stuff. I know you all think I'm crazy. I'm not. I'm going to go do the seance with Joan because this is real. And you guys, and whereas Steve and Peter in particular, they're supposed to be the ones of like, she's freaking crazy. You know what I mean? And she and now, because of the death of the mother, it's triggered a whole lot of other stuff. And, you know, in that sense, like, there's that loving side to both of them. Like, we get it. You lost your mother. You didn't really like her. But then you lost the daughter. And the way that happens, which we definitely have to talk about.
Right.
But you have to have a stance on it. And it can't veer one way or the other.
And then the end takes away all of that, though.
I just don't get the whole, like, why it can't and how it should be, like, part of what you're saying.
Because most characters in any movie have a hard stance on something. And the arc...
Mm-hmm.
is generally them learning, oh, wait, I got to change my views.
Right.
Okay. And I don't think she was aware as to what was happening to her at all.
Yeah, she wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, and to me, the way that it was played was the choices that she made, we as the audience understood, but because she never said anything to the family, they were sort of left in the dark. So you can see the misdirection, or you can see that the miscommunication and the confusion upon the family. But then at the same time, it did make her appear as if there was like this mental illness that was hereditary. Again, to me, this is a metaphor for the demons that are in this family, right? Mm-hmm. But then at the end, it's nothing of that is left to any imagination. I mean, I think the great conversation is how much is mental illness, how much of it is supernatural, is there supernatural? But she too clearly gets taken over after her husband burns, who to me is like the biggest tragic figure in this, because he's just trying to like...
He's burying his head in the sand.
Yeah, he is burying his head in the sand, but he is trying to like move along and try to play nice guy in a sense.
Right.
And I found it interesting that when she first threw the diary in, or the book in, she starts to go on fire.
Yeah.
And then was she setting him up to be lit on fire? Because if he threw it in, he would go. I don't know what was happening, but he ends up becoming toast, and that's when things start really.
Let me ask you: is this, are there too many ideas in this movie, despite the slow pace?
I mean, even if there are, like, so what?
Well, that's like, a problem. Here's I will know. Say I from think having it's a made movies, for me.
Yeah,
having made movies, to be honest, like the more singular an idea you can put into a movie, a book, a piece of song, whatever it is, the stronger it will resonate. And you know, I think it.
I guess, yeah.
Let's shift gears a little bit. I mean, into
Charlie. It does have that like that through line that this is a family drama. Like it's, I mean, it does. I mean, it does have a lot of things to unpack. But I mean, the through line, like.
But it switches to me. It switches conveniently based on the scene. Like it has very powerful individual scenes. It mm-hmm. really does. Like the dinner scene. Between just the three of them, one of the most powerful scenes I've ever seen in a movie. The death of the girl, one of the most powerful scenes I've ever seen. When we talk about the reveal as far as her not wanting him and you know trying to have a miscarriage, very powerful scene. But it's in a way it's what's convenient for the scene, not what's true to the characters. I feel.
Yeah, and I don't think that, like, so, and again, it's just going back to my earlier statement. I think part of what makes good horror movies is able to look into them deeper, whether it's metaphorically or not. That's one of the reasons why Halloween is my favorite horror movie, because you can just look at it as a suspense potboiler, and that's a movie that builds. same thing, well, I mean, The Exorcist is just a scary movie, and again, it's dealing when you talk. It's dealing with family drama, with a priest who has some issues as well. There's lots of themes in The Exorcist that can easily be explored, or you could just look at it as a possession movie, right? The same thing with going more modern and current. You know, The Witch is a movie that you can talk about, whether it stands on religion or turning your back on religion. Yeah. Feminism as well. This movie, too, you could accept that the end is so hand-fed and the exposition was so purposeful, it sort of kind of negates whatever conversation that you'll have. It's like, oops, they were doomed, fate happened, he's dead, he's now payment, it's a cult, that's all it is. Done. And nobody has to live on in that family with the burdens of what just happened to them because they're all dead. So they don't continue to go on. It's not like Rosemary is still alive at the end.
Yeah.
It's like, I know that they tried to make a shitty sequel on TV and it didn't really work. Well, I didn't even know that. Great.
That's funny.
But, you know, I mean, she's still alive and that to me is the horror of it all. Damien, the original Omen, you know, the son of Satan, and Gregory Peck, I mean, Omen lives. I mean, that's a downer of an ending. Like, the devil lives at the end. He wins.
I want to bring it back to this movie, though, specifically, because at that, number one, I feel like we're spoiling way too many movies. Number two,
well, if you haven't seen these movies.
Well, I can't assume that everyone's seen every.
Are you saying that there's nothing like left up to discussion because of the fact that it just it leads up to like a cult and everything?
Yeah, I mean everything's told. You're told exactly what happens and what it's all about.
I disagree. I think it's cool, like dissecting the little bits of like the imagery that you see and how the cult was able to control everything from the get-go and how. Like that whole thing about Annie's subconsciousness coming about, that's why she, you know, that's why she didn't want to have Peter. That's why the mom wanted, the grandma wanted to control, to have Peter. That's why she took over Charlie. Like, there's little bits of things here that you're able to talk about. And on top of all those little bits that are in the movie, you can also have a discussion of how this is a reflection of our time and how it represents American helplessness and how, like, we as citizens of this country, especially in this time right now, feel so helpless in controlling our lives and who dictates our politics and our rules of governing.
Yeah, and that's all fine. I get that. All I'm saying is for the movie, to me, it's far more interesting if, because everything you just said about the movie is, it was all dictated by the cult. That's it. Like, there was no, like, it takes away. I mean, again, Toni Collette's character, again, as Annie had no idea that her mom was into the spirituality of this all, right? So Annie herself felt that her mom was off her rocker, that she probably, because she felt like she wanted to kill her son and burn her son with turpentine and a match. These aren't things of a sane person. And so that teetering is, wow, is the stuff that's happening around them, do you go, is it live or is it Memorex? Is it real or is it in her head? And then when it's all explained that it's not in her head, they were all guided. And I get the hereditary factor of it all. But then it takes away, well, she really wasn't mentally ill. She was just guided by this. This was a family thing. And now she's part of this cult.
I mean, to be, when we talk about the death, one of the interesting things for me.
Which death?
The death of Charlie. The very important death early on. I thought it was very interesting to stay on Peter the whole time and the way it went about it. Right. To be honest, the way it cut, you know, afterwards we get her scream and all that, and then we cut essentially months later and so forth. I almost thought that Peter was trying to pass this off as if she had gotten herself killed somehow, because we know she sleeps in the treehouse. Mm-hmm. Peter's been asked multiple times, like, "Hey, where's Charlie?" He's like, "I don't know." Mm-hmm. And there was the very deliberate lines of, "Oh, they're home." I thought for sure, "Oh, they'll think they came home." Then they wake up. It's like, "Where's Charlie?" "I don't know." And then all of a sudden, she's dead. And I'm not saying I disagreed with the way it was played out. I think it was far more interesting in that sense. But again, it just, they set up these little clues for me that didn't, and then switch them.
May I ask a question?
You were misdirected, pretty much.
Overall, yeah. As far as that.
Misdirection doesn't bother me in a horror movie, but I'm going to throw this matzo ball on the table. But once we find out, once we're given the answer to this, and you think of the movie going back, so Charlie was supposed to be payment.
Right.
This is the way that I get it. Charlie dies of this horrific accident, so then they
She died because she wasn't a man.
Right.
They needed a man.
So she was a temporary vessel for payment.
So she dies and then goes into Port Pete. So once you figure that out, you're like, oh, okay. Everything is explained. Like, it takes away from what you were saying about, well, that's a horrific death. And we knew that something was going on because Charlie was seeing things that nobody else was. She was seeing demons, whether they be in the funeral home or in school or in class. She, too, was not necessarily, cutting off a bird's head and such. So you figure something's up with her. And it's just, once it's spoon-fed, it takes away all question as to what was going on here. And that, to me, like, for a good horror, sometimes, you know, you're meant to feel uncomfortable. And the movie does, to effect, make you feel uncomfortable many a time. But once it explains everything away, you're like, oh, okay, it's a supernatural movie. It's really not. Everything has been laid out for this poor family and for everybody before them.
So wouldn't that same sentiment be felt then as well throughout, like, The Witch and also Rosemary's Baby then, since it's all kind of spoon-fed for you at the end and the exposition is just like, boom, cult, boom, it was Black Peter.
Rosemary's Baby, she doesn't know what the hell's going on with her the entire time.
Neither does the family in Hereditary.
We're talking Rosemary. The family here, they all die. Everybody dies in that family. So that bloodline's gone. So I don't know if they ever do a sequel, but that bloodline's gone. As far as the witch, and I forget what the girl's name is, she already was showing sparks of rebellion, right? Going into this as a teenager. And she wasn't necessarily buying into any type of supernatural, But she knew that that the religion was so harsh on her that her freedom was to, like, she just...
Right, yeah.
Once Peter the Goat starts talking, like, that's a very chilling moment. Mm-hmm. And when you see her floating up in the air, she's like, okay. Like, she made a decision. Mm-hmm. She didn't have to, but she made a decision. She saw her mom get killed, her dad, her brothers, her sisters, all through this tragedy. In this movie, this family was just not given that choice. And I understand fate. Fate plays a huge part in Halloween. But they're dead now. So there is no more bloodline for them. There's no carrying on. And I don't know where payment goes from
I'm
here.
I'm going to move the because I did feel like at this point we've spent 30 minutes on the same question. So I'm going to move it along a little bit.
But this is what I find is good about discussion on these kind of movies.
Which, by the way, if whoever side you're on, or if there's a third angle to all of this,
I'm just asking questions.
I'm not saying don't.
Hey, listen, I'm going to take you all out for beers, and we can keep going with that same question. But I do encourage you guys to leave a comment, rate, and let us know what your opinion on the matter is. I do want to switch it for a moment because this is maybe similar to it, but at least it moves us forward. Very deliberately, the sound is part of something, and it almost, interestingly enough, becomes a simulacra of itself, because my movie theater in particular started doing that. And
I would hate that.
Yeah, but because there was, in a sense, for me, sometimes at times so little to grasp onto, by the way, this started happening the later the movie got.
Did it? Okay.
Well, because at that point it was like, okay, where is this headed? And people sort of started to see, and I did too, started to see the unraveling of all of this, into it's either going to go really well or it's going to be slightly contrived. And in this case, it was slightly contrived, and it just became, you know, this thing that people had to do to release tension and just be like, okay, I'm watching this and it's not going the way I want, so I'm gonna turn it into something it's not supposed to be because it's already not going the way I want it.
Right. I'm gonna ask a question of the book now. You've seen it twice. Did you see it together the first time?
And I have not seen it together at all.
I saw it both screens. I saw it in like super skeleton theaters, as in like there was almost nobody around. Yesterday I saw it at 11:30 in the morning, and there was only four of us, and one guy walked out.
And what about the first time?
It was a Thursday night at 11:30, and there was like about 15 maybe.
So it was the preview night.
Yeah, it was. Okay. Yeah, I didn't have the luxury to watch with the crowd, which I really wanted to.
Can we go into then at the very least, because I want to talk about my audience too. Yeah. I did not have that happen.
I would hate that.
I'd
cuss someone out.
But here's the thing, and I guess this is, you tell me, Captain, sure. My Captain, if we can. No, seriously, if we want to talk about, do it a bit. I want to talk about the trailer. Because I know the theater that I go to, my neighborhood theater, is very big on horror films. They're very big on action films. They love going to these kind of movies. Like my neighborhood, where I live, horror is really big. And I can honestly tell you that seeing a horror movie at the theater that I go to, which is, I'll just tell you, it's Baldwin Hills. It's a Cinemark theater. It is so much fun to see horror movies with this crowd. They are fully engaged. They get fully scared. They scream. They'll yell back. The audience will yell back at the screen. They don't do it in an obstructionist way. It's just they're engaged. And to me, it's fun to see. There's an energy in there. I wanted to talk about the trailer because the trailer sold a particular horror
Juliet,
movie.
Play the we'll play like the first 30 seconds or something like that. Sure. Go ahead and pull that up when you're ready. But I agree with you. It was very much dictated on this little girl, or at least from my perspective, and sort of her essentially being possessed, which isn't necessarily untrue.
And the clucking.
And the clucking. And if I really look back on it, to be honest, maybe we joke a lot. Maybe I took my stupid pills this week. But I don't know what the hell the clucking is besides a weird noise. It's just a cool device for a movie.
For the,
turn it up a little bit?
As in, like, for the film, what it is? Or, like, what
what's
what
the greater... Point? What's the point of it?
Here we go.
Let's listen.
And then we were...
This looks like a clip from the movie.
This is the one. Trailer, please. Trailer.
I don't know. I guess you could take it a couple of ways. I mean, it could just be like a weird effect that they wanted to play with the sound, or it could be like...
That's exactly what it is. It's just a weird effect they want to play with the sound.
But it could also be like you have a spiritual demon that's inside of a little girl, and the little girl doesn't know that it's this demon, so naturally this little girl is just a weirdo, and she just clucks. Like,
here we go.
It's an expression of, like, an entity being inside of a body that isn't used to that.
Then read this out loud. It's to make things start. She isn't gone.
I don't like this. Dad, I don't like this.
I think my mother put a curse on us.
Oh, I love that scene. Oh, I want to go watch it again.
See, just from that, it sets up a very supernatural movie with no element of disease as far as mental illness.
This sets up a Conjuring type of a movie.
Yeah.
Is basically what it looks like. So, going into this, I can honestly tell you, I had the theater that I saw it in was, I would say, about 80% full. And this was on a Thursday night at about 7 o'clock. It was about 80% full. And like I said, for most horror movies, this audience is very engaged. I can honestly say this audience was wandering. They were getting up. They were going to get more concessions, to get more popcorn. They were taking their time. They were not engaged. Now, I had known only because they said they had sort of set this up, like producer of The Witch, that this story was going to play out, that it was going to be sort of this deliberately paced, as I lovingly say. This audience, that's not what they were getting from the marketing. So I think I don't know how else you market this movie, but I think with that bait and switch, hence your extremely low cinema score, right? Because they were fed something that they expected that trailer to be that type of a movie. They didn't get that. This was 2 hours long, and it's very slow.
And that's an hour less than what originally was supposed to be. And in that sense, it was originally supposed to be two parts. I feel like you're fidgeting because we're making you upset.
My ass is hurting.
Uh-huh. Thanks for that, lovely.
I'm sorry, these seats, man.
but it was supposed to be two parts overall, and it very much feels two parts in that sense. And, you know, one of the interesting parts is, like, when the cast talks about filming the movie, when the long shots are held, they were very deliberate. Like, they said, we're going to shoot you, and we're gonna stay on you for a long, long time.
Which I totally respect and appreciate, because I think that is an art that's lost in a lot of filmmaking today. We talk about it here. Some movies are so over-edited. They never stay on a character. We never linger after a line of dialogue has been said. And if you linger on a character, it lets that thing set in. And I get that. All I know is that the audience I saw it with, they didn't get it, and they wanted no part of it. They'd rather go get their popcorn and Coke. Some may not have even come back.
I gotta say, I don't know. I think, thinking back on it, I think this is the best way to market this film, because this film is not for everyone. Like, if they were trying to market the film to what it truly was, it wouldn't have gotten, like, asses in seats. And the way it was, it worked. It was a successful film at the box office. I think the marketing worked, in my opinion.
Oh, I didn't say that it didn't work. Oh, okay. All I said is, I don't know how else you market this movie.
Right.
A24 had to market it this way, and I completely get it. I mean, it gave them their highest box office opening. But their drop is going to be, I believe, I feel...
Which is sad.
It's going to be substantial.
It's so sad.
You have to kind of look at it this way, too. At what cost? Like, there's a side to it where I forget the term right now, but where companies make a lot of money, but they dishonor the customer, and eventually in the long run it starts to affect the bottom line. And I also, you know, for Ari Aster, you know, when I speak about him, I think I want to see him as a filmmaker. I want to see more of his movies. I think he took a shot, if nothing else. He knew what he wanted, and he went for it, and I applaud him there, and I want to see more of his stuff. So truly nothing but the best for him. And so I worry that by doing that, it is a disservice to him.
I just don't get. And coming from Lionsgate, where we cheated a couple of movies, you know, with the trailer, it's what you have to do in order to get butts in seats. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to do. And horror now is on this great wave. Everything's cyclical. And right now we're riding a very high wave. And when you see this trailer on whether it be or like an Annabelle creation, or I forget what other movies I saw this trailer
right,
on.
Right.
I mean, it plays well. And so, but at the same time, it angered people. You know, hence you get a D+ instead of maybe a B. Maybe if you had like gone out in art houses. But I get why they wanted to go wide, and I don't. They should have taken the shot. Take the shot, do it, get it out there. A24, I think, delivers great content and great variety. I've said this from the beginning, since like seeing movies like Ex Machina. They take good risk. I think they, along with people like Neon, they're great for our business. So I don't begrudge them going this marketing route. And, you know, I always look forward whenever there's the A24 logo on a trailer that I see. I say, it's going to be interesting. And again, I didn't hate Hereditary. I just didn't love it as much as everybody else. There's disdain for this movie, but I can understand why there is. I get that. It's not being discussed. Everybody's like saying, if you hate this movie, you're not a movie lover, you hate horror movies. It's like, no, they were sold a bill of goods, and they didn't get that bill of goods. I'm glad that you liked it. I liked it too. I'm glad some horror fans like this movie, but I can understand why the mass audience did not.
Right, yeah.
Just like Mother got an F on CinemaScore. Okay, an F because that's how you market that movie. They cheated the trailer. You have to. This movie, I think, was better reviewed than Mother was.
It was like a D+ or something for Cinema.
Well, CinemaScore is a D+, but I'm talking like
the critics
flat
loved
out
it. Yeah, a lot of critics.
This
loved
movie
it.
Did far better review wise than Mother did, and right. I said this is a far better movie. I mean, this is an approachable movie. I can watch it. My issues with it are part of the storytelling, but I didn't hate this movie. But I sort of kind of knew going into what I may be getting, that I was going to get the stretched out movie. Two parts, I don't know if I'd want to come back for the second part, and I don't know where they would.
Yeah, the original cut was 3 hours
stop
long.
Stop it. Yeah, that's a long
one. I want to see that director's cut.
It did make $13 million over the opening weekend. As you predict, Dimitri, I think you're right. It's a huge drop off. But certainly made back its money, kind of with the budgetary at least.
Yeah, it was like, what, 10 million?
Yeah. So at least it's got that for, and I don't know. It'll be interesting to see it in this framework. What's interesting, Ari Aster wants to make a movie within every genre. Right. So the fact that he approached this, and you know, he says, I have loving parents, so don't think that this is my family on screen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he feels very blessed in that way.
He was an avid horror fan growing up.
Yeah, and let's, I mean, you know, just talking about a little bit of the production, when I was doing some research, I found that to be very, very actually fascinating. So even several years before the production began in 2017. So Aster actually composed detailed biographies and backstories of every single character that he wrote of. And that's even, you know, prior to writing the screenplay. So he had everybody's background all written out for him. He also designed a 75-page shot list outlining his specific vision for the cinematography. And this is, well, he didn't even have financing yet. So he had everything meticulously done, which I respect. Mm-hmm. Because we talk about people who don't do that, mm-hmm. and it shows. So I really appreciate that. As far as doing his production, like this movie, believe it or not, the house was built
on set.
It was built on a set
over in Utah.
Yeah, which is amazing. But I get it when you hear him talk about it. It's like, you know, if we used an actual house, it would have been more expensive. Believe it or not, he goes, we would have had to have taken down walls. I needed a house that I could move a camera through. Makes sense. Also, he stayed away from tropes of what make up haunted house movies that we're aware of, whether it's creaky floors, this, that. Although, the attic is a haunted house trope, and that the attic became a very haunted attic, so to speak, right? You know, when he uses seeing Toni Collette up on the ceiling. We've seen this done in horror movies, walking on the ceiling. I can remember The Exorcist 3 using this to a very creepy effect. But it was done well because we always saw that character up there. Mm-hmm. And like the last hour really ramps up whatever tension. What was the boy's name? I'm sorry.
Peter
goes up into the attic and he's being chased, and she's on the attic door pounding her head in.
Oh, yeah, that's so cool.
And I was like, really? That's creepy stuff.
Yeah.
Can't deny it. So I appreciate what they did from a from the construction of that set and constructed the
treehouse too.
Yep.
Well, speaking of, let me hope maybe this will creep you guys enough and leave a lasting impression as we wrap out. Millie Shapiro, for a lot of her appearances, she wore like a dress of sorts, and
I heard about this.
It was essentially like let's just say this, it was like trucks on shirts and buses and things like that, and with the hatch off or whatever.
Topless cars,
and. And, Ari looked at her, he's like, oh, wow, what a sense of humor you have.
Yeah, I believe Peter at one, Alex Wolf looked at her and she's like, that's really dark, man. Like,
you're dark.
Yeah, so she was, like, poking fun at her own character and, like, all the decapitations that happen in the movie.
Yeah, it's
so
nice.
Funny.
That's nice. Now, clever, I mean, from a box office perspective, the movie is up to $20 million.
Hey, okay. That's good.
So, you
double.
Know, for a movie that costs $10 million,
yeah. And a movie that's so polarizing too, and like it's not for everyone.
No, it's not for everyone. But that goes to why I think that the marketing, why they had to market.
Oh yeah, exactly. I completely agree with you.
They were taking advantage of the high wave that horror is on. You cut a trailer like that, you get $13 million. It's $20 million in right now. A24 is like, you know what? Yeah, we would love to have a second and third week. But we're doing okay right now. It's not bad because we had a really big opening for a movie that cost $10 million.
Yeah.
So.
Also, I appreciate what you said too, Phil, because like I didn't realize about like the whole disrespecting the customer in the sense, as in like they're giving this, they're giving the customers like the runaround in the sense, and like who knows if the masses of moviegoers. We'll trust A24 with another horror film. Like, who knows?
We'll see. I think ramifications can hold. It's tough to quantify, so
definitely going to keep an eye on. Like,
but all I can tell you though is, like, coming from Lionsgate, it didn't stop people. Like, we had this movie Bug. This is the one that I've referenced it before here. We so cheated the marketing. People got so pissed off at that movie, but we were still able to release Saw. Hostel, we were still able to release Open Water, things like that. So, no, I don't think it's going to tarnish A24. What it potentially could do is the horror fans like yourself and whatnot, They will buy the streaming or the hard copy, the Blu-ray. I'm not personally, I'm on the fence as to whether or not I need to get the Blu-ray, but it could affect that later on down the line because not so many people will buy a Blu-ray, but they may stream it. They may stream it once it comes out on demand. They may spend the $6 to watch it at home, and then they may turn it off.
All right. Well, we've exhausted ourselves. So.
Our time, not ourselves.
Our time, certainly. So we're going to wrap it up. But thank you guys as always. If there's plenty more that we could talk about, lots in discussion for a movie like this. So by all means, we encourage you to participate in whatever ways, whether that be the comments section, whether that be social media, which we will give out in one moment. All that is there for you to participate and continue the conversation. And in fact, we do love the conversation. Dimitri really loves it, but in particular with this movie, you will make Anthony's day if you participate in the conversation.
I would love to talk to you guys about this.
Speaking of which,
be kind.
Tony B, Tony underscore for Tony.
Yes, and you can find me there on Twitter and Instagram. Hit me up with everything you want, anything you want to talk about, specifically movies. I'm not that good at anything else. and also catch me on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Pacific time for horror movie news. Last week we did a spoiler-free sort of review and first impressions of Hereditary. And now it's been out for another week. We're going to do a spoiler review, spoiler-filled review of the of Hereditary coming this Tuesday at 4 p.m. with my co-host. So.
And at DMovies1701.
Yes. I'm not on Instagram because what do you need to see more pictures of this for?
Hey.
So, but yeah, at DMovies1701. You can always catch me here at Anatomy of a Movie. I've been a guest host on Meet the Movie Press, which has been a lot of fun. You should check that out. And then, you know, we've got so many movies coming out this, like, in these upcoming weeks.
Yeah.
Like, I can't wait to talk about Tag, Incredibles 2, Jurassic World.
Superfly.
No, Mission Impossible.
Lots and lots. If you are a true horror movie fan, we do have a lot of movies in our archive, so check that out. And we do have also, obviously, upcoming movies. We've got Halloween. We've got It Part 2.
Suspiria remake that I'm looking forward to.
Look at that. So much to look forward to. I'm at Phil Svitek. Thank you guys for joining us. We'll see you next time on another Anatomy Movie.
Bye. Help, hey,
Matt. Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.